One thing we haven't talked much about is sort of politics per se. Just curious about your views about how the country's doing right now politically, and and where you'd like to see it go.
It's a good day to ask that because I'm in an optimistic day.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Brian Young leads another player in the world of progressive politics and political technology. Brian is a founder of Action Network, a successful nonprofit enterprise that was incubated in the union movement and now provides organizing tools for many progressive organizations. Action Network provides an interesting example of a political software company in nonprofit form, with representatives of key clients on the product roadmap team. Brian and I met recently in person in Washington, D.C., and Brian told me his very interesting story of how he came to his place in technology and politics. So after our sponsor, my interview with Brian Young and Action Network.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is G-R-A-P-H-I-C-A-C-Y.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Brian. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Brian Young. I'm the founding executive director at Action Network. Going back far enough, I was actually a filmmaker in Vermont, did documentaries. And
one of my two favorite states.
Yeah, it's a great state. I really loved it. Loved being there and working there. And I knew Howard Dean a little bit, because I was working for the public TV station there and had interviewed him, been on interviews with him. And this is 2000, 2001. So first the Florida recount and then the Iraq War really politicized me. And I knew Howard Dean, thought he was a generally good guy. And I had gotten into kind of multimedia work with the documentaries. And then in the very early days of the blogs, had started to hang around the blogs because I had the feeling that things were going wrong and was very anti-Iraq war. So I started to hang around Howard Dean's office, had a little office on St. Paul Street, I think it was called. They had this Iowa ground strategy. And I started telling people, you guys need this thing called a blog. And, you know, you could get an email list. It'll be great. And they didn't pay any attention to me. But then Joe Trippi came in with a whole plan. And they said, you should talk to this local filmmaker. And I also had gotten to be friendly with a couple others who he had had contact with. So I worked there for a little bit. I didn't go on staff, but kind of the early days, I produced their launch event video and worked with some of the folks in the early days of trying to figure out kind of the digital
What was the launch event video like?
That was just a traditional, because that was a very traditional, that was my filmmaking. I mean, it was a very traditional, I rented a satellite truck and I directed the multi-camera shoot of his launch video. I mean, the one thing I remember.
Was it like him giving a speech?
Yeah, it was him giving a speech on Church Street in Burlington. And I do remember some Nader supporter going behind him with a big sign. and I was a very mellow director, but this was one of the few times I became like classic yelling director on the, what is that guy doing in my shot? but the
because a little bit of a problem in that in election before that, so yes, reasonable to be angry.
I know, I really was angry. Part of the reason I did that is I'd been working with them a little bit on the director, and I talked to Joe Trippi for a little while about taking over the HowardDean.tv, which was, they had a, at the time the technology was innovative that whenever you were online, because in those days people went online, you know, with a dial-up, a little bit of video would dribble into the background when you weren't, you know, your sort of unused bandwidth. So you'd go to a folder on your desktop and there would be high-quality video there. And I had a whole idea that I tried to get going with Joe about kind of a basically a running reality show of the campaign. I didn't even know if that was the term I used back then, but it didn't quite work out.
It was a little before its time.
It was a little bit before its time. He was thinking more like straight speeches. And plus I was like, I valued my time more than a campaign valued people's time, you know, in terms of money. So it didn't work out. But I kept that up, ran a congressional campaign in 2006 in Northern New York.
Which one was that?
It was a, it was an interesting campaign in some ways. It was the largest, one of the largest districts east of the Mississippi. It encompassed all of the Adirondack Park, almost. And it was a district that was a complete no-hope race. No Democrat had ever gotten over 31%. It was New York's 23rd at the time. John McHugh was the Republican who was in the district. And the Democratic candidate was a guy named Robert Johnson, who was just a doctor, really nice guy. And I originally volunteered to do some ads for free and work some digital stuff for him, but just kind of low-budget campaign ended up taking over most of the operations
for doctor candidates.
It's true. I never noticed that. And then Viggo Mortensen was actually from the district, and he did a fundraiser for us. So we had a little money to play with.
Nice.
And the media market was incredibly cheap. So it was a great experience. I was buying points and, you know, running the field program and doing everything. And
you cracked 31?
We did. We got 37. And I still, it was a 23rd district, and I don't remember, I don't know if you remember the Scosafava-Hoffman race right after Obama won. 2 years later, this was 2006, was the race I worked on, 2008. And I'll go back to my bio in a second. 2008, Obama won. He named John McHugh, the congressman, as the Secretary of Army, I think it was. So it left an open seat, and there was a race. And in 2008, the Democrat, we got about 37.5%, and I think the Democrat got about 37.5% in 2008, still lost big. But then there was a conservative and a Republican that split the Republican vote in this special election, and the Democrat got 37.5%, the same, but they won. So, of course, I was taking credit for that for everybody. But in the meantime, in 2007, I had, that race was really my, because it was really my shift into politics full time. And John Kerry was looking for a digital team because he had realized, you know, he wasn't interested in running for president again. But what do you do as an ex-presidential candidate with a big list? It's kind of something no one had ever tackled before.
Right.
And that was really the fun of that era of digital politics. There was a lot of, this has never happened before. Mm-hmm. So you could kind of make things up as you went.
So did you work with like Josh Ross?
It was kind of the transition from Josh Ross into, kind of took a lot of it in-house. And worked for a while to build our own system. Didn't really, interesting, I never made this connection, but I learned that building your own system is often a bad idea. And organizations trying to build their own technology, it's just all the budget pressures, all the political pressures, everything going into running an organization that has multiple goals is often incompatible with the rhythms of really building technology long term. So,
and then, of course, you're trying to build something that might be competing with something that's being built for a lot, the cost spread across lots of campaigns or organizations.
And really the we never quite got finished with it, but I also realized during that process, building technology is only
a little part of it,
right? And like finishing that first MVP in the tech terms, it's like having a baby, you know, I mean, it's an accomplishment, but it's only the very beginning,
right.
You know,
and you still need the village around the baby.
You really need to build it, nurture it, and keep it going. So, so we, you know, ended up switching using BSD for the technology, but, then 2007 and 2008, I worked with John Kerry, did a lot of advocacy, keeping his list alive, and then worked a lot with the Obama campaign in 2008. And from there kind of transitioned down to DC and, really throughout the...
Well, what was the main thing that you were learning while you're working with a Kerry organization?
You know, again, this is kind of early stage of digital politics, so...
Well, you're there through 2011.
2011, yeah. One of the things I learned throughout that period was the ways that technology was actually making it harder for us to work together as a movement. I did a lot. John Kerry having a big list. Everyone wanted a piece of that list. And there's institutional imperatives when you have a big list to protect that, it's an asset for whatever organization right. you're in.
You don't want to wear it out.
Right. I think some of that is often overstated. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot of studies now, you know, but this is 2007, 2008, and 2009 when people, all of this, no one really knew. So there was a lot of territoriality over the list. And I learned that you have to respect that. The sort of self-interest within organizations and really thinking of, you know, technology was making it harder to navigate those self-interests of organizations. And there's a common refrain in progressive campaigns when you're in a room with a lot of coalitional partners, or just in general, because when I went down to the Senate in 2009, I was working on climate change a lot. And people would always say, when you confront these moments of kind of negotiating interests, competing interests, why can't everyone put aside their self-interest and work together for kind of our common good? But the people saying that always mean, why can't everyone else put aside their self-interest and work on my campaign? You know, and everyone is doing this work because they believe in it. They believe in the organization they're working for. And you have to respect that. And from a technology perspective, I was noticing the ways that technology was heightening that dynamic instead of helping.
What's an example?
It's just like whose email list, who gets the email list, whose website is this going to be on? Yeah. All of these things were in a context of ownership. Mm-hmm. And there was really a way that campaigns had a single owner. And our coalitional table and the way we set up coalitions was a way of sort of sharing that ownership, pooling that ownership, but there was still one owner. That coalitional table was the owner. And it was a very brittle, slow, tedious process. And it seemed like in the days of technology, we should have a better way of doing it. Technology should be helping that mm-hmm. dynamic instead of, you know, heightening that dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that really led directly to the Action Network, because the times when I was working for John Kerry in the Senate, working on climate change, the stakes seemed so high, and they still do around climate change. And I'd have meetings in the morning with climate scientists in the Senate offices and think, we're going to die, you know, and then I'd go out and have these coalitional table meetings and think,
We're being stopped by the most petty stuff.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I didn't really... you know this dynamic too of starting something. I didn't really consider that. And I didn't even sort of consider all the pitfalls of trying to start something. And I didn't really consider myself the person who kind of would start. But eventually
But your next move was to Well and Lighthouse LLC. What is that?
That was a consulting. I was starting work on, originally it was called the Corporate Action Network. And I was starting work on that. And I wanted to time at John Kerry's office. The Senate and me just didn't really mesh very well. So I went to Well and Lighthouse. This is a 2011 going into 2012. And I worked with a lot of the super PACs, mm-hmm. especially the Senate majority PAC for the Democrats, and did a lot of digital ad sort of work and traditional sort of super PAC work for Senate, which, you know, I'd learned an enormous amount in that period too about just the way you reach people with ads and
give me an example of that.
One of the things, I'll go back a step. In when I was working for John Kerry, I started something called Truth Fights Back in 2008, which was about anti-smear work, because obviously John Kerry had a
major
interest in that in that work. And you know, I spent a lot of time just watching how things spread and the way the right wing, you know, back then it was a lot out of town hall message boards. And there was definitely a way, you know, this is pre-Twitter, a way the email sort of viral email forwarding, the message boards on the right, things would bubble up and then they'd start to get mentioned on some fringe radio. And by the time like Rush Limbaugh and Fox were talking about it, they'd built up a constituency around this. Yep. So when I got to doing the super PAC work, you know, I could see all of that sort of shifting into the social media realm and the way that you can put, you know, throw out an ad. I remember doing an ad against Dick Lugar, actually, during the primary, using social media ads as sort of an ongoing message testing sort of environment. Instead of focus groups, you can do a lot more efficiently, a lot more, you know, and a lot wider with social media. So I did some of that.
How well did it work?
It worked, except we didn't put a lot of resources into it. Mm-hmm. You know, I came in you know, an existing sort of infrastructure of campaigning around sort of super PACs and Democratic politics in general. So, you know, they had a way of doing things. And people were open to trying some things, but in kind of a limited way. Mm-hmm. So it definitely worked. But I also realized I didn't, you know, a lot of this is personal. You know, I didn't really like it, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of stuff. And I really, that whole, it all seemed very kind of ephemeral and surfacey. Mm-hmm. And I felt like there was some deeper sort of power building issues that we had to get at.
So by this time, you've been decade and a half in some intersection of media, politics, technology. Mm-hmm. And what's the founding story for Action Network? What happened there?
Yeah, it's sort of a two-stage thing. The first stage was really around that question of how we can get systems that help people work together and organizations work together, how we both get tools into more people's hands, distribute the use of technology, because mm-hmm. technology at the time was really concentrated in sort of digital professionals, how we get tools into more people's hands, not just in a change.org way, because that's change.org was getting popular then, but really in a sort of deeper way, and also do it in a way that distributes the actions but creates mechanisms for people to work together. So, you know, being in climate, and like I said, it was called corporate action at first because the analysis was a lot about sort of the way corporations network themselves together throughout the 20th century, and our counter measures from government to campaigns are still sort of stuck in an older geographic-based paradigm. So launched that, and the first thing we built was actually distributed tool set and distributed event tool set, and got some money from, made a connection with a guy, Mark Fleischman, and he and I sort of founded this organization. And
who's Mark?
He came out of old labor organizer, you know, worked on the Norma Rae campaign, had been working that for a while, and had been working with Change to Win and SEIU. So we built, you know, he had the sort of campaign background, and the original idea is we'd build this technology and help, you know, run campaigns as sort of a coordinated thing, and worked with the UFCW Making Change at Walmart campaign in our Walmart around, they wanted to do something on Black Friday. And this is 2012. And something with the workers, some sort of worker strike of some kind, and get it in, you know, multiple stores. And I had been thinking about this distributed event model. So we built with them, directly with them, advising, helping guide the tool sets. We built a system of distributed events, sort of day of action distributed events. Where everyone,
what does that mean exactly?
Everyone could go to a single website, or we made the tools embeddable so it could be on any website, put in their zip code, find the local event, or start their own.
Okay.
It's something that happens all the time now.
And it's something, that presidential campaigns had built things like that, or right, that kind of tool was being built over and over again.
Yeah, and working with the, you know, MyBo in 2008 in the Obama campaign, I definitely sort of learned a lot from that. And also kind of the early days of the blogs, of the diaries, and just that sense of people doing things together in a coordinated way.
Sure.
So we built that for that first Black Friday sort of strikes and protests in 2012. Mm-hmm. And around in October, we're moving into the second phase of kind of the origin story of Action Network. Because we're going into that first Black Friday, I kind of have a couple of realizations. One is that this works. You could see that first Black Friday just taking off. And, you know, now we do those kinds of events all the time. Women's March, we as a movement, Women's March, March for Our Lives, this day of distributed events. But at the time, it was like, wow, this works. And B, there's no business model in this at all. You know, even as a nonprofit, there's no way of keeping resources flowing to keep this alive. And then the sort of big realization, because this is a time when within 2 weeks, Salsa Labs got taken over by the VC investors, and change.org switched from being progressive to anyone can use it.
Yeah.
So I really thought, you know, that we need to build a business model that works, keeps money flowing in, that technology can keep thriving, but also manages to stay focused on the needs of the movement long term, mm-hmm. and that it's baked into the business model, that it has to stay focused on the needs of the movement. And that was the real pivot from this sort of campaign tech thing.
So how did you accomplish that?
Because of that first Black Friday, we got kind of another year of funding from the, you know, the Change to Win and SEIU and the unions that were involved in that. So mm-hmm. we could build out the full suite of tools, mm-hmm. Email based.
And this was funding into, were you constituted as a nonprofit?
Yep. We were 501c4, okay. So people could use us for campaign related activities.
Okay.
You know, we had a 501c3 that the campaigns, at this point, they sort of split off. The campaign sort of went off. They still ran some corporate campaigns, but the tech was in the 501c4. We built that out and then launched in September of 2013 was when we really, the modern iteration of Action Network launched. And it was a traditional-ish in the sense of, you know, email-based campaigning is traditional-ish now. Tool set, email, fundraiser, petitions, et cetera. You know, we still had that distributed sort of model. And one of the things that was always different about our tools, because I was trying to solve for that problem of reducing some of the friction in working together, all of our tools were always embeddable on any website. So I could create, you know, an event campaign like the Walmart campaign. You could put it on your website, and everybody that came through your portal, you got. So it was a way of aligning self-interest instead of having you give up your self-interest to work on my campaign. And that was really a fundamental sort of point to those distributed tools.
So make that distinction a little more clear. Like, how does that differ than if they had used the BSD tool set or something?
So all the tools then, and most of them now still, if I created an event campaign, say we were working together in a coalition, there's sort of two ways. Either I was doing it on my own or my organization, or we were working together on coalition. We'd have to come up with one website. So you would either have to send people to my website. Your organization would send people to your email list to my website.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would get all their email addresses. It would be my campaign. You would be working for me.
Yeah.
Or we would come together as a coalition, sit around a table, negotiate over what the website should look like,
mm-hmm.
all get together on what the branding should be.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody sends around the language on the website to their communications department, their lawyers, go down a round of edits where everybody takes out the things they have objections to. It all gets watered down. It takes forever. Incredibly tedious process, mm-hmm. and it usually comes down with this watered-down product,
mm-hmm.
Because it had to be that one home for the campaign.
Yep.
And what I was always trying to do from the beginning is break apart that ownership structure of campaigns so people could own their piece of the campaign.
So if someone signed up for this campaign on a particular partner's website, they would get that list and would also go generally to the
yeah.
main.
So with our system, when we built that then, and still, I could create the campaign. You could embed the widget so people could look up, you know, their local event on your website.
Right. So there's an incentive for you to participate in the campaign because you're getting names out of doing it, plus the campaign is getting names.
Exactly.
Right.
And we don't have to negotiate over branding because it's on your website.
Right. I do it my way to add to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it really takes away a lot of those sort of friction negotiation points.
Got it.
To get a much wider distribution of the campaign. And the idea is, you know, everybody gives up a little bit of control for much wider impact.
Can you talk a little bit about how you put together this product? Like what technology base is it sitting on? What, mm-hmm. how did you integrate in email tools? How did you hire a tech staff, or how did that all come together on the tech side?
Sure. Yeah. And that was also one big point that made all this possible is the development of the cloud-based tools. You know, you didn't have to build everything. So we could really take advantage of a lot of that. So we could scale up quickly, things like that. Because we went from zero to some huge event, and we were on AWS, Amazon Web Services.
Yeah.
So we can do that.
Yeah.
So we used a lot of the cloud-based tools for that. And the origin story of the technology goes back a little bit further. There was I worked with a guy named Jerome Armstrong back in the day, and WebStrong, and they were building some technology.
That's the blogger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were building some technology that was used in like 2010. And one of the only place it had really been used was in a Brazilian Senate election in 2010. So they worked with some young Brazilian developers to finish it off. And then I started out using some of that in the early days, but we ended up developing something completely different. But I built this relationship with these guys in Brazil. So they became sort of the development partners in this. And they're still our development partners. Been working with them ever since. We're, you know, great friends now. And they
speaking English?
Yeah. They speak really, you know, English very well.
And so what's the database behind it?
The database it's a MySQL custom built database behind it. And, you know, our technology, we built it on Rails, Ruby, and the technology is sort of deliberately vanilla because a lot of what, you know, we want to have a wide pool. One of the decisions going into that first Black Friday, when I was having this realization, we need to build a lot more, I brought in Jason Rosenbaum, who has worked at PCCC. I knew him a little bit because one thing is, as I'm sure you found out when you founded NGP, when you found something, you're doing everything and you find out what you're not good at. And I realized I was not a good project manager at all. So I brought in Jason to really sort of lead the product development of, you know, this new tool set we were going into. And one of the things that he and I talked about, this was really him more than me at the beginning, was, you know, really wanted to use vanilla technology at the base of it because two reasons. One, it's a much wider pool of developers you can sort of pull from. And two, the whole point of what we're trying to do is to build infrastructure for the movement. We want things that are reliably and dependably both work and are focused on the needs of the movement long term. The level of we want to be innovative in a lot of different ways, but we want things to be built on a rock solid foundation. So really focusing on tested, tried and true sort of technology was both more efficient because of the developers. It's also cheaper. There's a lot of libraries out there already to develop on. And we knew we could rely on it long term because in the end, reliability has been key to everything we've been trying to do. We want the tools to always work because the point of the whole business model of nonprofit, and I'll get to the business model a little bit more, is really to be, you know, that reliable, dependable. When people want to send an email, the email should work. Mm-hmm. You know, all that kind of thing. These are sort of the core tool sets of the movement. You know, if they're using one little app for one specific feature, you know, if that goes down at a time, it's people are annoyed, but it's not their core. And everything that we do is built towards that sort of core of the programs of the movement. So we always wanted to be reliable.
So how did you go about building this as an entity, you know, supporting the software, selling the software, all of that?
Yeah, a lot of that, you know, all of it was bootstrapped. You know, we built the first tool set, and then we really realized we needed some core partners to make this work. You know, we were a nonprofit, so we couldn't offer ROI to investors. You know, nobody's going to get a return on investment to it. So we really needed some real partners that could make this work, and we needed to build it in a way, rather than giving up our sort of ideological focus, we would give up some of the control and really think of it as in a cooperative mm-hmm. sense. So we really found that partner in the AFL-CIO, mm-hmm. Which in outside people might think that would be an odd partner.
And if I'm trying to dredge out of my memory, they were using Salsa or some version of that as their emailing tool.
Yes.
And they weren't very happy with it, right?
Yeah. I mean,
they had
problems with Salsa, and they were also rightly concerned when the VC investors took over Salsa. Yeah. They could see the writing on the wall.
It seemed like that might become bipartisan or...
And really, because what happens is, you know, our movement is not big enough to give the return on investment of a major VC investment. You have to sell to other people to make that investment work out. And, you know, Salsa started to sell to, you know, nothing bad, but like, you know, churches and hospitals and, you know, other nonprofits and different use cases. And when you spread out the development over too many use cases, you're not really focusing on the needs of the movement anymore. Mm-hmm. So AFL-CIO, and at the time, the director of digital strategies there, it was Nicole Arrow. And, you know, she first was thinking about building something, you know, in-house because mm-hmm. they needed something long-term. They needed something reliable. And quickly came to the realization that that's a bad way to go. Mm-hmm. And then at the time that she was looking for something, we were also sort of searching for, you know.
You met in the middle.
Exactly. And really, you know, it was with her that and with the AFL-CIO that we built the sort of partnership co-op model that we have. Mm-hmm. And the way that we set that up is we have a development committee, call it the Platform Development Committee. And that committee collectively sets the roadmap for development every year. So our core development is driven by that committee.
Who's on the committee?
Right now it's us, AFL-CIO, and Daily Kos.
What an interesting trifecta.
Exactly. And we, for a couple of years, we deliberately kept it just to the AFL-CIO because we were kind of working out how do you build in this model where, you know, in Silicon Valley, you talk a lot about sort of user-driven design and co-design, things like that. This, first of all, was before those buzzwords, but also it's a different model. It's not just an advisory committee, but this is actually a decision-making body. Mm-hmm. And that body also collectively funds the roadmap. So mm-hmm. that's the way we both keep the technology focused on the needs of the movement long-term mm-hmm. and also keep it funded. Mm-hmm. Because if you...
So you're going to talk about your business model.
Yep.
I assume you sell it to your... to your partners.
Yep. Yeah. That's sort of the core, that sort of development committee. We're talking to some other organizations about joining now that we're bigger and more sort of established. We have a special business relationship with them. You know, they sort of fund that. There's some other fund and they, and then we, because of that, we can make it available. Like our minimum is $10. We have a free version of the tool sets. So we try to make the tools and we do this with our development too. We always think of all the levels of the movement, the needs of, you know, a digital department at AFT or Working Families Party or, you know, sophisticated digital department or Daily Coast is very different from, you know, a small grassroots organization. But the goal, both in the technology and the business model, is to serve all of them, mm-hmm. serve the full movement mm-hmm. in a way that, from that very original sort of approach, values their needs. You know, we started with that campaign and valuing people's needs and recognizing the self-interest of organizations, but doing it this way too. So the committee, you know, spends multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. These are big organizations with sophisticated needs. And we have, you know, people giving us $10 a month and we have people giving us nothing using it. And the way we set the, what, you know, sort of the non sort of PDC members, everybody else gives us money based on their email volume because that's our biggest variable cost mm-hmm. is email volume. And you mentioned support earlier. One of the real benefits as a both for everybody, but especially as a business model of the way we develop technology, because building with the people using it in this sort of very direct, concrete way that we do it with this committee mm-hmm. puts necessarily a high premium on design. The tools really have to work for them. And because of that, our support needs are actually very low. Mm-hmm. So as we have scaled up in size, our support, we haven't had to build a huge support. You know, the one big difference between the one real, you know, sort of break, I guess, on our growth compared to a VC-backed firm is, you know, when we got to that point of, okay, we're growing and can show this hockey stick of growth, I couldn't go to Silicon Valley and get that sort of next round of funding.
Because you're a nonprofit.
Because we're a nonprofit. Yeah. So that has...
Although some nonprofits seem to convert over.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
have you considered that?
No. I mean, yes and no.
I mean, because Salsa started out as a nonprofit, right?
Right.
And somehow navigated their way out of that.
Right. Yeah. And we sent out an email a couple of weeks ago. We have a little subsidiary. This is some stuff that we had to do. But the whole purpose of this is to rethink the incentives of building technology and building software in a movement context. Yeah. And there are ways I could imagine getting Silicon Valley money, but it's not in a for-profit sense because the whole engine of VC money there is often on the 10x return. You know, they're
have to be more of their charitable sides. Or
yeah. And the interesting thing is, and there's a lot of, you know, good charity coming out of Silicon Valley, but we fall in a weird sort of uncanny valley for them. You know, the uncanny valley in robotics when as a robot gets more and more human, people feel more and more warmly towards it until it gets almost, and then they sort of freak out.
I don't
know
that's
the uncanny valley.
I've never gotten that close to a robot.
It's also an animation. Yeah. Like if animation almost looks human but isn't, it sort of, you know, people get this weird revulsion. And I sort of have that. I can see that process happening when I'm talking to someone in Silicon Valley about who we are, because I'll talk to them. It's like, oh, SaaS business.
Yeah,
I know.
I get this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we get
their pattern recognition kicks in.
Yeah. We get to the we're nonprofits. Like, whoa. Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yes.
Did you ever have objections from AFL about having your engineering labor force in another country?
We've talked about it. I mean, that's the other benefit of being really like deep partners. They know it's not. When we first made the partnerships, someone anonymously who was against the AFL doing this, I don't know who it was, knew about, you know, our partners that were there in Brazil, and they tried to spread some anonymous, you know, AFL's trying to outsource their development. And the guy I work with down there is like, would you like me to send you a picture of our pool? I was like, that won't be necessary. Because we don't actually save much money because we, you know, we pay them well. But AFL always knew the relationship was not this outsourcing relationship.
What do you mean the pool?
They literally a pool in their office. They had a pool out back from their office because they had a nice office.
Oh, I see. So you're not paying slave labor.
Exactly. Yeah. He was making the point that we pay them well. And they, you know, when we, this year we worked out as we grow, we're sort of transitioning from a team to a real organization. We build an employee handbook and policies around vacation. We include them in that. So they're really,
how big is your team now?
We just hired two new people this week. I mean, we're still small for what we do, but we've got, you know, including our guys in Brazil, we're at 19 full-time and 3 part-time.
Starts to be challenging to manage around that
size. Yeah. I mean, we have very little. You asked about sales earlier. We have one person dedicated. We call it partner development, not sales.
So how do new clients / partners come to you?
It's almost all word of mouth.
Yeah.
And you know, that's always the most effective way anyway.
What's like a modal partner for you? Who's the typical campaign or organization that's using Action Network?
We're much stronger in organizations rather than electoral campaigns for a variety of reasons, kind of where we focused. And plus having a essentially non-existent sales staff, it's a lot on relationships and word of mouth. And that's actually the benefit. That's where one benefit of our model comes in, is because we're really focused on the needs of the movement, people feel better about us.
Seems like a selling point, right? To say, you know, we're part of your team.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, the counter example in almost every way to how they built was Nation Builder. Very similar time period as us. They were a year
but
before.
But very VC,
open to anybody.
Right.
You know, Jim had a very strong ideological bent to what he did, but it was not partisan ideology. It's just more tools and more hands.
Right.
You know, the sort of internet is my religion. And that was a real hindrance for them in building the kinds of partnerships we do. Because the kinds of partnerships we create, by necessity, people need to feel a sense of shared values and shared goals. It's who we are. You know, like a person, that is both a positive and a negative depending on the context. It means we can't get VC money, so we don't have a big sales staff. So we rely on that partnership with people. And it's just, you know, it's who we are.
How do you see sort of the competitive space that you guys inhabit?
It's changed actually over the last 2 or 3 years. You know, we launched in 2013. Salsa was probably our biggest competitor, and they're almost completely gone. When people are deciding now, they never come up as a choice.
They got acquired or got a bunch of money or something recently.
Yeah, I mean, they still have a viable business. It's just not in our market as much.
Yeah.
They sell to a lot of nonprofits and things like that. They rarely come up. Some people are still using them.
Yep.
Blue State Digital is a big competitor, mostly in electoral. That's still somewhat true in electoral. Mm-hmm. But NGP Band and Every Action, it's often Every Action or us.
Salesforce,
some organizations, like very large organizations, will use Salesforce in some parts of the marketing cloud, emailer, and the whole sort of Salesforce app environment. Mm-hmm. That tends to not work well for people, though, because those things are based on an entirely different set of use cases.
When people are choosing you, why are they? What is distinguishing you? What's making you better?
The mission and values are important, both because people just like allying with people who share values, but also they know that long term will be focused on their needs. You know, in 5 years, they won't have to switch. They may have to switch for other reasons, but they won't have to switch because we're off, you know, selling to other people. But concretely right now, the main advantages are the tools really work. Our deliverability is high. You know, the email, your legislator tool actually delivers emails, and like a lot of tools, you know, we really do concentrate on them, like the end result of them being what people expect them to be.
Do you run up against like the phone to actions of the world in that, in the advocacy sort of
sometimes space? Yeah. But a lot of those we, you know, we integrate with things. We try to do what we do well, mm-hmm. and not do other things. You know, we have some new tools coming out later this month that are based on organizing, you know, as opposed to sort of digital mobilization, but real sort of community and workplace organizing.
Yeah.
And we built that very deliberately as a totally separate tool set, mm-hmm. because that was the other thing that Nation Builder is very different from us at the beginning is we're always cognizant and aware that the production database can be optimized often for one thing or another. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to do too many things in one tool set that are really sort of opposite in the way you use a database, mm-hmm. especially, you're having to fudge your optimizations and sort of try to fit things together. Where, you know, we're building a digital tool set with the Action Network, and that's what it's for, and it's not really a phone tool. So we really always, from the beginning, we concentrate on API and trying to build a good API so people could integrate in with us.
So keeping your focus.
Yeah, keeping the focus there and building in, really thinking of ourselves as part of a tech ecosystem, and we're not going to be everything for everybody. And the other big thing, back to the question about the federated organizations with multiple layers, that is where we are, you know, almost a different, you know, orders of magnitude better than anything else. The way that our system works within federated, partially because of that initial sort of distributed model.
You're architected for a federation.
We're architected for it, and we have a lot of systems in it that help organizations work together, like we did at the beginning, right. But within federated
so organizations. So give an example of a federation that uses you and how it helps them out.
Labor unions, you know, AFT, take them for an example. Mm-hmm. Our system, you can syndicate down content. Mm-hmm. Content can flow down and data can flow up. So there's often a problem in organizations where, federated organizations, where the local organizations have the relationship with the members, mm-hmm. but the resources to run a digital program are at the top of an organization, at the national level. And local organizations are correctly and understandably jealous of their relationships. They don't want the national organization just always emailing their people, mm-hmm. But they don't have the resources to run a good program. So the national organization can set up an email, syndicate it down. So then it appears as a draft for the local organizations, and they can change it however much or little they want. They can just change who it's from, send it to their people. They can localize it with local stories, send it to their people.
Does that make it a good fit for a presidential campaign that has lots of subgroups and stuff?
It could. Yeah. It could. The presidential campaigns, the subgroups, it works better for established local organizations. Mm-hmm. And the DNC started using it with state parties a lot this last cycle, mm-hmm. Where they could create an email and syndicate it down. You know, they can do rapid response, mm-hmm. things like that. Our revolution uses us with a lot of their state local organizations too. But when things form, there's just a wide variety of sort of use cases within that. And that's another thing we do with our partners is work with them on sort of training programs and things like that.
Where do you want to take Action Network into the future?
Yeah, I mean, there's two sort of questions. Because the one thing is Action Network is both an organization and a tool set. You know, and the tool set, last year we built some, now we're in 2019. So in 2017, we built an automated drip email tool.
What does that mean?
It's, you know, the commercial emailers have done this for a long time, but you can set up a whole series of emails. So if someone signs up, depending on user behavior, you know, if someone signs
up, it's like a tree of different emails depending on how they respond to
exactly.
it. Yeah.
People are only just in the last, you know, this last cycle, really sort of digging in on how to use that.
Is that sort of going down the road of like the inbound marketing tools?
A little bit. And the finding those sort of areas where we can either really help people's sort of digital program and continue building good integrations with others and reacting to the needs of the movement there. But as an organization, we're coming out with these organizing tools and really extending our model of because I think the key to our organization really is around this model of building in this cooperative relationship, and I use co-ops in the traditional sense of a co-op, relationship with parts of the movement to build that core infrastructure that the movement needs. We had the digital tools and realized there's no good organizing tools, and that's really a core tool set. So we're working with that and really trying to come up with a way of having that same cooperative approach to kind of the R&D for the whole organization. What does the movement really need next? Mm-hmm. And what does it need that is good for us to tackle? The humility of knowing we're not going to do everything is an important part of building a good tech organization. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not set up right now to spin up apps quickly. We're really set up to work sort of deeply with practitioners in the movement to find those core infrastructure tools that they're going to build a lot of program on, and they're going to need to rely on for years. So really keeping that model growing. And also we're starting to get a lot more interest in use overseas, in how we translate that movement focus, when the shape of the progressive movement is different in many parts of the world.
Do you find yourself building relationships with the digital consultancies that are looking for tool sets? Mm-hmm. How does that work out?
Yeah, it's, and it's very much a relationship. We tend to shy away from some of the business incentives with...
They don't get a percentage of your...
No. And we don't get a percentage of anything. Just because, again, the same way with the VC money, I'm always focused on incentives, mm-hmm. And really aligning incentives of us with the sort of movement and the partners. So, but we have good relationships with sort of mission aligned consultants, and, you know, really talk to them about what their needs are, and they're part of the sort of conversation. You know, really fundamentally what we're about is an ongoing conversation with the movement, and, you know, consultants are a big part of it, especially in the electoral space.
One thing we haven't talked much about is sort of politics per se. Just curious about your views about how the country's doing right now politically, and where you'd like to see it go.
It's a good day to ask that, because I'm in an optimistic day. I go back and forth between pessimism and optimism, and there's reasons for both. Clearly, the things are better, you know, today than they were 4 months ago, because Democrats have control of the House. There's a huge opportunity in the next 2 years. This is my optimistic side. There's a huge opportunity in the next 2 years because, you know, a lot of what the right wing is doing in this country is trying desperately to hold back the tide and to do everything they can to build their power so that they kind of can have a minority rule, essentially, of the government. And my pessimism and optimism is it always feels like a race because they're doing lots of things that are effective that way. But at the same time, I really do think that there is a huge building wave of activism and just raw numbers on the left that if we do well over the next 2 years, because there's going to be so much activity going into that election, I really do think that the next decade could be significantly more progressive in this country. Yeah, exactly. Knock on wood. But doing it well is not just winning. Yeah. It's winning in a way that builds infrastructure.
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is a lot about the battlefield that this podcast is really about. I wonder how much the resistance organizations that sprung up since Trump was elected are using your tool sets, and how you've viewed these new orgs that are out there.
Oh yeah, I mean many, especially the local groups. You know, many
of
the national
Indivisibles
groups, of local Indivisible groups are using us. You know, Run for Something uses us. Swing Left uses us. Women's March obviously was, you know, the from the beginning was using us for that distributed event, and still uses us for their core tool sets. Mm-hmm.
So you've been kind of at the helm of a new organization. What advice would you give to someone else who's trying to build an organization in this progressive space?
Really listen, I think, and have respect for the movement. I think that's one of the places where it sounds sort of banal, what I just said.
It doesn't always happen, particularly from the tech people that come in and think they know more.
Yes. Right? Yeah. And that's,
is
really,
that what you're thinking about?
Yeah. I'm really talking about the tech, because there's been a lot of Silicon Valley tech.
Where they get a quick look and they think they know it. And then a little bit later, they're like, this is more complicated than I thought. Right. There's a lot of politics in this politics.
There's a lot of politics, and the needs are slightly different. Yeah. And the, you know, if you really, you know, there's a lot that can be built. And there's you know, great stuff, you know, being built now. There's a lot of great things that have been popped up. And I think one of the real differences is the ones who really have respect for the movement and look at it as building tools to make the activities in the movement better and stronger rather than disrupting what's happening, you know? Mm-hmm. And I also think being appropriately humble about how much money is in the movement. You got to build a lean business model.
What do you think of the new, to the extent you know anything about it, the new data wars that are going on?
It's really tempting to say no comment because I just want to stay out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I'll take it in a totally different direction. Yeah. You know, it's hard. You know, I will say that it's really hard. I know people at the state party level. I know Rafi and his team at the DNC level. I'm sort of second, you know, one step removed from some of the people in Silicon Valley. And like, I think they each have points, you know, it's just hard for them to sort of align that. What I said earlier about the sort of way we think about data in communities, I think the way we approach data and the movement and tools in a lot of ways is very Silicon Valley-esque. You know, we look at data about people, and the voter file is set up as essentially a marketing database in a lot of ways, where we build demographic and behavioral characteristics about people so that we can reach them with a message to get them to do something. You know, in the for-profit commercial world, that's to get them to buy something, but we want them to vote, or we want them to donate, or we want them to go out to an event. But it's the same general process. Mm-hmm. And the people in the voter file are individuals, and the relationship in the database is generally between that person and the organization. And then we do cohort analysis around people. But, you know, as I've been focusing on organizing a lot, organizing and communities, and a lot of what's happening in the way people are trying to use digital tools in communities, organizing is a lot about relationships between people. And our databases aren't well set up for that. And our systems are set up in that Silicon Valley surveillance model. And I think that thinking of our tools and our data as vehicles to connect people to each other instead of just to our organizations. What we've done is great, but I think that we need to add this component of really thinking of data and tools to connect people within communities. You know, I know, I remember talking to Michael Slavier a while ago about, you know, sort of graph database, and he was building a database. But, you know, you really need the tools to feed that data. And that data is very societally powerful and politically powerful, but it's not that commercially valuable. Yeah. So I think it's really got to come out of us as technologists in our movement to really start to build in this direction.
What should I have asked you that I have failed to?
I can't think of anything, really.
Well, it's been really great to get to know you a little bit and to hear about Action Network. Anything else you want to say?
No, I mean, one thing I will say is I'll sort of combine two of the last answers when you asked about both kind of the technology about that I just talked about of building communities and also what we're doing in the next 2 years, and also the innovations of kind of local organizing. I think all of these are pushing the same direction. If we can be successful as a movement in coalescing it, there is an avenue for us to really look at the next 2 years and the first part of the next decade as a time to build new technology, to really work on collective action, connections between people, community building, that these local indivisible groups, local swing left groups are hinting at and moving towards, local our revolution groups. And the technology is not quite there to really build at the community level right now. And the databases are still set up for this one-to-many sort of surveillance marketing approach. And I think that the space is there for us to do something different that will really sort of change the context of politics in this country.
Do you spend any time looking at what the right does for tools, and do they have similar? Or are they ahead or behind? What?
Some. Yeah. Interestingly, when I was looking at organizing tools, because the first thing, because we had digital tools, I wanted organizing tools to integrate with. Wasn't really thinking of building something. And the only thing I found that was actually close was something used by evangelical megachurches to sort of start new megachurches and build committees and stuff like that. But when it comes to technology, there's been a kind of a pattern that the right wing technology tends to focus a lot on communication from the message boards and the viral emails. And on the left, we see it a lot in the negative communication that has, you know, sort of moved into the bots and things like that. But it's not just that, you know, they really spread information really quickly mm-hmm. throughout their movement. And I think that's one thing that we can do a little bit better at is really spreading information, finding ways to spread information quickly. I haven't found that many tools for really mobilizing people and organizing people on the right that are even as good as what we do on the left.
That's good to hear.
I mean, it could be out there.
Yeah.
I spend more of my time in my movement.
Yeah, we all do. Brian, great to talk to you today.
Yes, it's good to meet you. Good to talk to you.
Take care. That was Brian Young in Action Network. He's at actionnetwork.org. I'm interested to see how Action Network will develop in this cycle and those to come. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.